Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Rex Gilroy, who in 1974 was the Archaeological Director, the History Director, and Director of the History Museum at Mount Victoria. He discusses the possibility of other ships having visited Australia before the Dutch. This includes the Phoenicians, the Chinese, Malay, and even Vikings. It was recorded 1st of March 1974, and duration is 1 hour and 13 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, my particular research to our early history is more concerned with what you'd call the unwritten history of Australia, the history which is well overlooked by conventional history books, but I feel is a page which should be included. There is certainly a lot of circumstantial evidence which traditional historians tend to overlook, but I feel that the circumstantial evidence is so large that something ought to be done about it. At least I feel that an open mind should be kept as to who were our earliest discoverers, because let's face it, we know next to nothing of what happened before the Dutch voyagers reached these shores. Concerning Captain Cook, I feel he was a great navigator and definitely the man for the job, but he was by no means our first discoverer, although the centenary in 1970 seemed to put more publicity on the Captain Cook line. Many school children I happened to meet in some of my talks at many of the high schools, many of them were unaware of many of the Dutch voyages. They thought that Captain Cook was our first discoverer. But it is a generally unknown fact that British Naval Intelligence in 1769 acquired a very interesting chart from the Portuguese. This chart showed the very crude outline of our east coast, with many of our bays and rivers and inlets clearly defined, including Botany Bay. Therefore, Captain Cook may very well have been on little else than a pleasure cruise and not really a voyage of discovery at all. But, of course, the map was crude. It remained for Captain Cook and other great British navigators and explorers after him to make the map more clear. But it is certain that in 1500, the Portuguese established trade relations with the Chinese. And amongst many of the items obtained from the Chinese were a number of early charts which showed all of Southeast Asia, most of the coastline of New Guinea, and our northwest, northern and eastern coastlines of Australia. The map of our east coast is believed to have been copied from one of these Chinese charts by the Portuguese, and an identical chart to that used by Cook, dating 2,500 years old, can be viewed today in the Taipei Museum, Taiwan. Chinamen could very well have been here. They were trading as far south as Java. Their junks were flat bottom. They could just sit on the water like a cork, perfectly seaworthy and far better than some of our later European vessels. The Chinese, in fact, and the Japanese are known to have been in these waters going back a very long period. At least 2,000 years ago, a Japanese fleet is believed to have explored our northern waters, and in 1434 a Japanese pirate called Nagamasa claims to have visited every land from Japan as far south as Australia. And in about 2,500 years ago, a Chinese emperor called Kami Iharibiko ordered, a Japanese emperor, Kami Iharibiko ordered a fleet of almost 300 vessels out to conquer Sayo, meaning the great south land of pearls, for the Heavenly Empire. One wonders what happened to this Japanese invasion fleet, whether it reached Australia or not, but the results are not known. But there seems to have been earlier voyages. It's certain that many Mediterranean navigators had knowledge of lands outside the Mediterranean. How else could Plato have written a line to the effect that beyond the Atlantic and other known oceans of the known world, there are large lands which will one day be opened up. He also said that in that comparison to the, by comparison to the rest of the world, land occupied the smaller part. In 115, a man by the name of Crates of Melos in Asia Minor constructed a 10-foot metal globe on which he described the known continents of his time, Europe, Asia, Africa. He called Oceania. What could be termed North America he called Periaceae, and South America Antipodes, and a vague southern continent, which he believed was necessary for the balancing of the earth, he called Antoece. Was Antoece Australia? We don't know exactly, because it was supposition amongst many of the early Greeks, Phoenicians and Egyptians that there had to be a southern continent to balance the earth, otherwise everybody would fall off. But it is known that the Egyptians did recognise a round earth. And there was a great Egyptologist who in 1942 in the Cairo Museum, Professor Baeger, who actually later established a museum in Alexandria, claimed that the pyramids faced the known continents of the earth, and that they pointed to Australia, America, and Europe, Asia. Whether this is anything or not, we can't say. But early this century, a number of tomb remains came to light, and my slides concern this. We do know that Greek and Roman knowledge did speak of the southern hemisphere. In 400 BC, Theopompus, the Greek scholar, claimed that beyond Ceylon there was a great continent of immense extent. Whether he was talking of America or Australia, we don't know. In 300 BC, Pliny wrote that the Romans established trading posts in Malaya, Ceylon, Borneo, and all over Southeast Asia, and that one important trading post was established in the delta of the Mekong River. He also said that to the south of Malaya there was an unknown land wherein dwelt strange animals that kept their young in pouches attached to their bodies for safety. Had Plato seen a kangaroo or some such marsupial? There are many mysteries. But watercraft, this is the main fact. Could Egyptians and Phoenicians living 3,000, 4,000 years ago have had the means to explore these waters? Well, certainly they did. According to Dr. Inskand Ibrahim, the Egyptologist from Cairo University, who is now in Australia, the Egyptians built vessels up to 150 feet long and as much as 60 feet wide, sometimes two or even three decks. Sometimes they would start off on a trading expedition with a single deck and take extra shoring along. As they got extra trade goods and found little space, well, they just set up an extra deck to leave them on. Well, the Egyptians were definitely taught by the Phoenicians to build their watercraft. And as early as about 3000 BC, according to the most ancient writings, what appear to have been Indians were shipwrecked on the Red Sea coast. And in return for being taken back to India, these navigators promised to show the Phoenicians how they could sail on drift currents, monsoonal currents, which were taken from the Red Sea across to India. These same currents were then used at a later date to take the Phoenicians as far south as Java. This has been recently discovered that Phoenicians were definitely in Java. But nonetheless, once a profitable trade relationship was set up between India and Phoenicia, the Egyptians, after being taught to build better wooden craft by the Phoenicians, followed the Phoenicians into the same waters. Recent excavations at Borobudur Temple in Java have uncovered new wall systems. And on these walls, archaeologists have found new inscriptions relating to it that about 3,000 years ago, the island was visited by Persian and Babylonian traders and also apparent sun worshippers from the Middle East, literally sun worshippers. It is certain that the Egyptians had no wood. They obtained wood with the help of the Phoenicians, who used to sail their ships for them, sometimes down to Punt, sometimes to Ceylon, but definitely they obtained wood from Africa, cedar from Lebanon particularly. And Punt is an interesting proposition. According to many legends, Punt was located in Somaliland. Yet there is some difference of opinion. Many of the Egyptian legends, such as the story of the shipwrecked sailor, all refer to Punt. Punt, in fact, was a conglomeration of many stories of navigators that were shipwrecked on unknown lands. And these various shores came to be known as Punt. Punt, nonetheless, was located to the south. According to Professor Bernard of the Sorbonne, Punt was indeed Australian. One particular Osirian religious philosophy includes a legend of Punt being a continent located in the Indian Ocean, and to which the Egyptians believed was their ancestral home. Thus, this religious belief was enough to entice many Egyptian seafarers to try and locate their mythical land of origin, and so no doubt this led many of their vessels into the southern hemisphere. Professor Imskand Ibrahim believes that the Egyptians may have sailed across the Indian Ocean on a direct route to our west coast. He believes that they obtained gold from the west coast of Australia and brought this back to Egypt. But nonetheless, there is evidence on the west coast. Recently, well-known Perth skin diver Alan Robinson discovered the wreck of a Phoenician trireme submerged off King Sound. The Australian authorities would have nothing to do with it, but the Smithsonian Institute in America obtained wood samples from the wreck and carbon dated them. The dating is at least 700 BC. A bronze plate retrieved nearby the wreck has been found to be covered in Phoenician script. In the Kimberleys, in 1931, a team of Sydney University archaeologists and anthropologists led by Elton, A.P. Elton, discovered strange racial characteristics among certain Aboriginal tribes of the Northwest Kimberleys, including certain religious rites, which led him to believe that they were of Mediterranean origin. The Aborigines had Semitic or general Mediterranean racial features and were found to speak Egyptian words in their language. Many of their words for various parts of the human body are identical to the same words used for various parts of the body in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. It is possible that Egyptians could have been, or Phoenicians could have been, shipwrecked on our northwest Kimberley coast and settled down with the locals and died there. Otherwise they may have landed and then sailed off. Or perhaps, as Ibrahim suggests, there was considerable contact with our west coast for the purpose of obtaining gold and other precious items, in which case there was extensive contact over a great period, which allowed many of these religious rites and philosophies to be imparted upon the Aborigines. The Aborigines, for example, believed that men from the west came across in great ships in one area, landed, killed off all the men but kept the women, which, if true, seems a sensible thing to do. The Aborigines believe that at death in the Kimberleys, their soul boards a canoe, which is rowed by a ghostly boatman called Whalewaite across to the west, to the Island of the Dead. Or in another area, Whalewaite conducts the soul of the boat, if you wish to call it, across the path of the sun to the afterworld, ruled over by Guyon, the sky god, who sits in judgment and decides if the Aborigine has been good or bad. The Aborigine has been bad, he is eaten by a crocodile, and if good, he's allowed into Peralta. It is very similar to the Osirian religious belief that at death the soul was conducted in the soul of the boat by Thoth into the presence of Osiris, who weighed the weight or crines of the soul against the weight of a feather on a pair of scales. If found just, the soul was allowed into the afterworld, but if unjust, well, he was eaten by the crocodile god Baal. In 1875, the Shevet expedition landed on Darnley Island in Torres Strait and discovered strange canoes, shaped like the boat of Ra. They were used for funeral processions. The natives, when deceased, were embalmed. First, the internal organs were removed and the brains extracted through the nostrils by a bone instrument, similar in shape to the metal instrument used by the Egyptians. They then implanted artificial eyes of pearl shell, embalmed the corpse and rowed him to the west, the direction of the afterlife, incidentally, to the Mediterranean, out to sea, usually to a coral reef or another island, for interment. But such a mummified corpse and a boat of Ra were retrieved by the Darnley Island expedition and brought to Sydney. You can now see them in the Maclean Museum in Sydney University. Professor Edwin Doran of Texas A&M University is a world authority on watercraft, and he has spent many years researching in Southeast Asia. He has identified Egyptian traits and other Phoenician traits in many of the vessels, but particularly Egyptian in many of the vessels of Southeast Asia, in the rice boat of the Irrawaddy, on the Ganges River, and also throughout Malaya and Indonesia generally. He is of the opinion that there was considerable culture contact from time to time, but it is certain that the Egyptians were trading in these waters. They traded all over Europe and the Near East, and often the peoples they traded with obtained many items from them also. This specimen was removed, it's a gaming box, removed from Tutankhamun's tomb by Howard Carter, from whose early book this slide is actually taken. The wood is made of cedar, or at least the gaming box is made of cedar, which of course originated in Lebanon. The next slide shows a folding camp bedstead made of the same timber, which came from the same region. There was in fact considerable contact, because recent excavations of tombs, both in Egypt and in the Near East, right up into Babylon, have proven that many Egyptian items were traded there, particularly with the Israelites, Babylonians, Persians, Canaanites, and vice versa. But what Howard Carter and also Petrie, that period, was astounded at was the number of boomerangs that turned up in Egyptian tombs, and some in Babylon. Petrie, in fact, believed that the boomerangs and throwing sticks that he recovered were definitely from the west coast of Australia. They were identical to Aboriginal designs. They could not have been the work of Egyptians, unless, of course, if Egyptians had landed and the Aborigines had copied the idea of the boomerang off them, which is not believed by most anthropologists. They believe that someone was here and that the spear thrower and boomerang were removed to Egypt. Historians are unsure when this actually took place. Possibly it was at least 3,000 years ago, but at least the spear thrower and boomerang turned up in Egypt about that time. And also, methods of hunting were employed on the Nile River, which the author Einel Idris discovered in 1914 were identical to the same hunting methods used by Aborigines on the Mitchell River. He, in fact, recognised certain racial traits over there amongst many of the locals that were identical to some tribesmen that he had actually come across. Next slide, please. In fact, here you see a ship of the type I was talking about, anything up to 150 feet long and more, and anything up to 60 feet wide. So they definitely had very large sea-going craft. Thor Heyerdahl and a number of other anthropologists believe that the Egyptians and other earlier navigators were able to make extensive oceanic voyages by using the drift currents. The method of the Mediterraneans for trading with Southeast Asia was to sail on the monsoonal currents in summer, which would take them around to Southeast Asia, and they would return following winter by the same means. These currents could take them not only to the northwest Kimberleys, but could also direct them through Torres Strait into the West Pacific. In fact, in the West Pacific, excavations are now going on in Duatom in New Britain, New Caledonia, Fiji and Solomon Islands by Professor Bernard Brew of Noumea, who has found lapped potsherds dating to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC in very ancient deposits in these islands. How did Mediterranean pottery come to be in that area? Admittedly, many of these relics could have been dropped by early antique hunters or early settlers. It's possible, but then again, when you find a relic at 20 or 30 feet, this is something that remains to be questioned. Here you can see how they actually traded, the Egyptians, in this scene from a temple, or at least a tomb painting, show a ship landing. Canaanites trading with the Egyptians. The next slide is a facsimile of the tomb painting. It shows the Canaanites landing and their goods being weighed, measured and brought by the Egyptians on the waterfront. You can see some Canaanite women in the far end on the right-hand side in a group, their strange clothing. But this is how many of the trading goods were brought to Egypt, or even vice versa, to other countries, and this is how they have turned up. Recent discoveries in Egypt have proven that some contact between Central Americans and Phoenicians must have taken place. At least several hundred Phoenician inscriptions have been discovered, and some Hebrew letterings in one area of Brazil. There is also talk in the ancient legends of great ships who brought fair-skinned gods across the seas. The white gods with horned heads are quite popular amongst the Pacific Islanders, particularly the Solomon Islanders, who said that the white gods stayed with them for a while before sailing on again, but in the meantime taught them how to make their strange war canoes, which are termed the Mon by the Solomon Islanders. Before the missionaries stamped out the cultures thereabouts, the natives used to go on great expeditions for heads and what have you, in great ships which were remarkably like Viking longships. They had a high crown stern with snake figureheads. The natives even learned how to make round shields which they hung along the side of the ship to keep the water out in choppy seas. They had masts and sails which were very much like the early Norsemen, and also the ships had up to 20 oarsmen on each side, 40 oarsmen. So they were quite large. But who were these horn-headed white gods? Could it be that many of our ancient navigators sailed far beyond their traditional waters? Traditional history places the Vikings in the Norse lands. They're not allowed to go any further than America, yet than North America. Yet two Viking longships have turned up in the mud of the upper Amazon River and are now on public display in Buenos Aires Museum, 75 and 30% intact. A Viking helmet has been discovered in the Arm Stanley Ranges. Only in February 1972, a native digging in his backyard unearthed a strange metal horned helmet, which he brought down to the coast and is now on show in Port Moresby Museum, on public display. Whether an early collector took it up into the territory of the headhunters in the early days and dropped it there, we don't know. I don't know how a Viking helmet came to be in New Guinea, because it's the first time it's ever been known to be there. No private collectors possessed Viking helmets. But up there were found red-haired, pale-skinned natives. And there are strange place names throughout the Torres Strait region which are akin to Egyptian and Mediterranean words. It could be possible. Next slide. Another slide shows a battle between the Egyptians and the Sea Peoples. You'll see that the strange garments of the Philistines, actually, the Egyptian ships engaged the sea raiders in the delta, a relief from the temple of Ramesses III at Medinet Habu Thebes, circa 1170 BC. Note the bird head prow on the sea raider ship, right, the corselets and crested helmets of the Philistines, the horned helmet of the Sheridan soldiers, lower right corner, and the Philistine round shields and short swords. Many of these items were used by the Egyptians. The Hyksos gave the Egyptians their armour. In fact, there is a strange carving in Australia amongst Aboriginal designs which shows such a figure. Next slide. This is a well-known carving on the Hawkesbury River. A number of star carvings, or in the Hawkesbury Nepean district, we'll say. Vandalism, of course, gets to many of these carvings if they're open to the public, so we like to keep their exact locations a secret. Whereas out of 100 people, you might have one sincere person, the other 100 may be of the type which, if not, vandals will go away and talk a lot, and other people will come there and scratch Joe Blow was here all over it. This carving is possibly an Aboriginal, but it shows a bird or reptile head figure on the front of the ship, and it's certain, it should be the other way around, but the carving does indicate that an Aborigine, if an Aborigine did indeed carve it, saw a strange ship on the river and copied its design as best he could. Another carving up that way, I believe, has a similar ship with what appear to be strokes coming from the side as if to illustrate oars. But it is unlike any recent European vessel that ever sailed on the Hawkesbury. The carving is extremely ancient. It blends in with the wood, in with the rock, sorry. So it is extremely ancient and greatly weathered. The front of the sail is missing, if it ever was carved, but nonetheless it shows that an Aborigine, like many of his people, saw strange things from time to time and tried to interpret them as best they could. I think that is a very good carving of a strange vessel, and I'm prepared to believe that it is something of non-European style. Next slide. Among the strange evidence of the Northwest Kimberleys are the famous spacemen carvings and paintings popularised by one Eric von Daniken. True, he may have a lot of things going for him, particularly in other countries there may be carvings and paintings that, if given the benefit of the doubt, you could say were spacemen. My theory is different. I don't think that is the garments of an astronaut. However, an Aborigine, if he painted this, unless someone else did, the Aborigine who possibly painted this tried to copy either a prayer band around the top or tried to imitate writing from somewhere and put it around the top of the headband. But it is an exaggerated headband, or perhaps a prayer band, or at least a hat. Someone even interpreted as a coolie's hat at an angle, and this could be so. There are many other carvings and paintings in the Kimberleys that show the typical spaceman type figures that you've seen. Well, if you look in Chariots of the Gods, it's a very good example of the Kimberley Wandjina, but if you look closely at the garments, the short sleeve which ends at the elbow, the dress which ends at the knee, and then it has baggy pants in many cases, and what appears to be either an identity disc or some garment, a pendant or something in front, clearly the garb of early Mediterranean seamen. Next slide. Here's another strange carving from the Blue Mountains region, from the European area. We'll say the figure, well, Eric von Däniken would call it a spaceman, but once again it looks very, it could be a little fellow blasting off in a space capsule, but you've given the benefit of the doubt, but I think possibly it's a totemic carving of an Aborigine or someone, perhaps. It's a strange carving, but if it is a totemic carving, which it could be, it's unlike normal Aboriginal rock art. They have been influenced possibly by outsiders. A series of carvings found on the Blue Mountains before a council road was put through were removed for safety. The middle top figure is dressed in, once again, the spaceman type outfit. But what is a spaceman doing with a diamond shaped shield? A headdress which could be the futa, the sunshade or the sundress of the Egyptian or usual Mediterranean seamen, Phoenician, Egyptian, Arab, all use the futa as a sunshade. And what appears to be a breastplate is in front of the figure, and he also has baggy trousers with what appears to be boots. They are totemic figures, but Aborigines, do not forget, had no clothing. So who did they see to copy the design from? The bottom middle figure is Biami, with little cross bands running across his chest and hair sticking out on end. Biami is the sun god of the Aborigines in eastern Australia, and in the Hawkesbury River region, where many strange carvings and paintings of this style are to be found, and in recent weeks a new gallery has been discovered with many of these strange figures. It is being kept secret so that tourists won't do the usual damage. But Biami, the sun god, has the same soul-judging functions as Egypt's Osiris. The sun worship with the mother goddess cult seems to have sprung up in the Hawkesbury and been introduced over the migration trails by the early Aborigines through the Colo River around Liddesdale, from where it radiated out into central New South Wales and was discovered in the 1870s. But like the sun worship cult of the northwestern part of Australia, it is unlike normal Aboriginal religious philosophy. We believe it is alien in origin. Next slide. Here are some hand stencils from Liddesdale. Next slide, in fact, should even have a mother goddess. But the hand stencils are a point of interest. They represent the rays of the sun in the Liddesdale area. The mother goddess is called popularly the Piccaninny,
But the Picaninny has broad hips, and this is a typical fertility symbol of the mother goddess of the Mediterranean region. Strange that the Aborigines seem to have copied the idea. Perhaps they could have obtained these ideas through independent invention. It's possible. But if the diffusionists are right, many of these ideas have been introduced by early seafarers. One argument that is often explained away by many academics who do not like to change tradition much, or I think these people at least should be prepared to keep an open mind. As I say, I'm not asking you to believe my claims, but at least keep an open mind on the whole thing, because so much is changing these days. In fact, if the diffusionists are right, many of these ideas have been introduced by early seafarers. One argument that is often explained away by many academics who do not like to change tradition much, or I think these people at least should be prepared to keep an open mind. As I say, I'm not asking you to believe my claims, but at least keep an open mind on the whole thing, because so much is changing these days. In fact, they would say that if Egyptians and other peoples had been here, why are there no pyramids, temples and what have you? Why is there no greater degree of influence? Not generally so. Australia was barren. It was not good for living for very long. Perhaps if Phoenicians and Egyptians had been our west coast to obtain gold, this does show that some degree of contact had been made, but they would have only been little less than bases from which to obtain these items to ship away. It is believed that trading posts were established in Central America by the Phoenicians. They taught the locals how to make better pottery, sailed away for a year and came back, and when the natives had improved their pottery, it was believed they took some of this back to the Middle East for trade. This is why Central American styles of potsherds have recently been discovered in Egypt and in Phoenician ports, particularly in Phoenician ports. But likewise, similar items of Mediterranean origin are coming to light continually every year, makes new discoveries in Central America. The Ankh, the Egyptian symbol of eternal life, the Ankh has been discovered in Mexico. In fact, according to Dr. Ibrahim, recent discoveries of some of the temple pyramids produced altar stones which, when turned over, were found to have the Ankh carved underneath them, symbol of eternal life. Next slide. A wife standing next to... wife standing next to two strange figures on the Blue Mountains. If they are Aboriginal, where did they get these styles from? Why the strange clothing? Had Aborigines seen Mediterraneans, or have they invented clothing out of their heads and it just happened to look like that worn by Egyptians? My interpretation is that the figure on the right represents a sun worship deity, because it has a solar disk above its head, a strange pooter-like headpiece, and what appears to be the fragments of clothing. It's very weathered. The next figure, near the ruler, shows a row of stars around the horned head of a figure with an eagle or bird-like belt, and a cross band running from the shoulder with a strange symbol on the chest. Perhaps this is the moon goddess of Mediterranean, or is a moon goddess of Mediterranean origin, we don't know, but if not, at least we think the Aborigines, if they did not invent the figures themselves, if they did carve them at all, copied them off someone else and introduced them deeper inland, because this has been found on the Upper Blue Mountains. They are identical, in fact, to many figures found in Egypt. Chiefly, the one on the right is identical to many relief carvings in Egypt, particularly in Luxor. Here's a close-up of the moon goddess back the front. I'm sorry if I mixed some of these slides up earlier. You can get a very close look at it. Notice the nose comes right down over the face, which is unusual and reminds me of certain figures in New Guinea, where you find a moon goddess with a pair of horns surmounted by a moon disc and stars etched into the wooden frame. Once again, we have horns surmounting figures in a country where there were no horned animals before white men introduced them in the last 200 years.
Wata natives throughout the Pacific, throughout New Guinea, Torres Strait and Northern and Eastern Australia doing with horned-headed figures in their rock art. Unless they had obtained the idea from someone else, they could not certainly have invented horns unless they had seen them either on Viking helmets or on some Mediterranean helmets, or else they had seen a picture of a horned-headed animal that was brought here by someone, or at least the idea was copied from early visitors by one means or another. That is my theory, that it is of a non-Aboriginal art style. It has definitely been introduced, that is, if Aborigines carved these figures. They are on a vertical rock face, which is, once again, a very rare thing with Aborigines, to carve on a vertical rock face. They prefer to sit down and carve them, although, at least, there are many such carvings all over Australia, so sometimes they do stand up to carve them. But once again, the art style is un-Aboriginal. Next slide. And once again, we have a close-up of the other figure. What is he? Is he a spaceman? An Egyptian? Or is he just some imaginary carving invented out of the head of an Aborigine? This is the argument often posed by many traditionalists. They believe that the ideas were just invented by the Aborigines and just happened to look like people on the other side of the earth. Next one. And if these are Aboriginal carvings, I'd like to know why. They are unlike any true designs. They are more like the Egyptian god Horus. In bird form, they nonetheless are sun worship symbols. They include the serpent and the sun disk. But you see bird-headed figures with sun disks above their head, and the seated figure is holding what appears to be an orb in his hand, while above the head is another sun disk. I myself do not believe these carvings are Aboriginal. These are in fact ones that I would say more so than any of the others resemble identical hieroglyphics. The Egyptians, I have trace them. These are found on the Blue Mountains near the Nepean River. Next slide. Near the National Park region was found a large head cut in relief out of a cliff face about 7 feet above ground. It's carved in relief, which is not an Aboriginal method of rock art design. If it was carved in the last 100 or so years, it has aged very quickly because it is the same colour as the rest of the rock. It could be early European, it could be early Mediterranean, but it is not Aboriginal design, and I personally think it is more towards the Mediterranean than the other. Next slide should show a close-up. One would even say he looks like an Aboriginal. Don't forget, Australoid racial types can be found in Egypt. But whatever it is, that is a mystery, that head, and it is rather eerie. My wife has seen it, has said the same thing. But it's extremely ancient. It does show age. Next slide. A strange carving found down at Campbelltown. A seated figure. If, indeed, an Aboriginal carving. How did Aborigines invent a chair or throne? And even saw seats. Once again, the figure could actually bear clothing or could have had clothing. It seems to indicate that he has some sort of headpiece, unless it was an animal-headed figure, clutching something, perhaps a sun disk, but most of the stone is missing. That was found near the George River in thick scrub. It was sticking out of the ground. It is, in fact, interesting to note that a bronze arrowhead was ploughed up by a farmer in the same district of Campbelltown in 1970. It's a Mediterranean item, but whether it was dropped in the last 100 or so years by an early antique collector, one cannot say. Next slide. But however, in 1912, Mrs. P. Burrows of Winona, a young woman archaeologist who at the time was living in Austenmere, excavated a rock shelter near Austenmere, and in 2,000-year-old shell middens, she uncovered this bracelet, silver, inlaid with lapis lazuli figurines. It was in ancient 2,000-year-old layers. Recent carbon dating of the layers has supported this. What was it doing at such an early period in an Aboriginal rock shelter, unless Aborigines obtained the item by some means or another, and it has been discarded amongst their shells and being allowed to remain there. She is quite secretive about it. She won't let it out of her sight. People in the Australian Museum have seen it, but she will not hand it over. I don't blame her. It's a beautiful piece. But you can see the Anki, symbol of eternity, in the centre of the picture, and little mummy figures and a strange hand. Professor Ibrahim has in fact interpreted the designs on the hands, and they could perhaps refer to the power of the Aachen, a symbol of Aachen art. Next slide, please. This is a rather interesting item which proudly is in my collection. It was discovered in 1969. Railway workmen digging for a pipeline trench 6 feet below ancient soil layers which had been allowed to collect naturally. There were floater stones over this relic when it was discovered, deep down in ancient layers. The workmen were digging at a point 2 miles inland from the entrance of the Latsan Gorge, which is part that empties out onto the Nepean River. A workman digging at 6 feet through ancient hard layers unearthed this relic, tipped it up in a shovel and threw it on the mullet heap. My father, who was supervising the work at the time, picked it up thinking, oh, it was a comic relic, or some old relic, and he brought it home to me. Well, to cut a long story short, it was later identified by university experts as part of a small axe used for mast trimming amongst the Mediterraneans at least 2,000 years ago. What has become of the rest of it, we don't know. Perhaps excavations carried out there might reveal more of it. But we don't know. What it is doing up there is a mystery. But it was brought home to me that same night, March 12, 1969, and it is now on display in the museum. It shows extremely ancient weathering. It's of bronze and some other alloy, but nonetheless it has been matched with other Mediterranean axes that were used for mast trimming and other shipbuilding work. Next slide, please. It's possible that a ship or ships have from time to time sailed down our east coast after sailing through Torres Strait and have over many months explored down our east coast, found the Hawkesbury River and sailed up it. Possibly this is why an Aborigine carved, or Aborigines carved, more than one strange vessel along the Hawkesbury and the Nepean Rivers. At Gosford is this strange 4-foot-wide sun disc carved in relief out of an 8-foot-high rock face. It's close to the top of the cliff, because you can see the foliage. This was found north of Gosford and is not the only such design. Eric Worrell's son and he were lost in scrub one day in 1969 and came across a rock shelter bearing strange designs which could be Phoenician, and amongst them was a ship-like painting. And the dyes used were, I believe, not normal ochres that would have been used by the Aborigines. Some sort of dye that was not available to the Aborigine. And they were not the work of recent settlers, we think. But the site is lost because they were lost and they were more interested in finding a way out of the thick scrub up that way. And when they did, they decided to try and relocate it. Since then, they have still been looking. Maybe one day they'll rediscover it. But the rock shelters around that area can be pretty confusing. Next slide. If Egyptians or people like them had been up the Hawkesbury, they certainly left some strange words amongst the early Aborigines. Words like Barara, meaning river of the sun, which was the term applied to the Hawkesbury, and the same word was used by the early Egyptians for the Nile at one period. What are the Aborigines doing with an Egyptian word? On the Hawkesbury are Chinese junks at Barara, and also two little funny little men dressed up in definite Asiatic garments. At Gosford, Eric Worrell's son showed me a set of 12 human figures dressed up like Spanish seamen with helmets and breastplates, identical. Above one figure, he holds a, by an arm, he holds a giant kangaroo about 12 feet. Another figure is holding a stick in this fashion, but they all have the outline of a breastplate, a barrel chest. They have spiked elbows and knees, which could be interpreted as armour joints. Depends how you interpret these carvings. They could be interpreted as spacemen, they could be interpreted as Spaniards, they could be called totemic figures. It's everybody's right to interpret the way they feel. I think we should keep an open mind.
but here is a sun disk very much like the Artem on the Nepean River. If an Aborigine carved it, he certainly copied it from someone else. The tongues of fire leading from it, mostly weathered away, but the bottom section is better preserved. Next slide. Further south on the Nepean River, there are three strange carvings I discovered within half an hour of one another. I was going down to look for some Aboriginal carvings in an area in June last year, and I discovered this strange symbol near a creek on a farm in thick scrubland. It's a candelabra symbol, and it's one of two Hebrew-type candelabras, but could also be a Babylonian species, and I have the name, which I've forgotten offhand, but it is definitely not the work of an Aborigine. If it was done in recent times, it certainly is pretty ancient once again. It's weathered. That far under the rock, it's fading away. It looks too old to be European, but I could be wrong. It could be the work of early British settlers, if they were so inclined. One fellow even claimed that convicts carved Masonic type symbols up at Springwood, and this is in a direct line with that. Similar symbols like this have been found there, but I don't think convicts had much time for that sort of thing, particularly when they had a fellow standing over them with a whip telling them to get to work. Next slide. Nearby is a symbol we have been definitely able to trace. It is the hieratic symbol for a scroll of papyrus. It is an Egyptian hieroglyphic. If it is Aboriginal, once again they could have carved the design out of their head, and it just happens to be identical to an Egyptian symbol, but it is within 100 feet of the other symbol. The symbol is only about several yards away, and it's the next slide up. A number of carvings weathering away, but the arm is rather unusual. It could be Aboriginal. Nearby there are Aboriginal axe grooves and knife grooves, which shows they moved through that area. It was in fact a natural area for them to migrate up from the Nepean River. So anyone who landed there on a ship might have walked inland looking for food. The fellow who dropped the axe blade up Lapston Gorge may have been one of the food gathering party that left their bark or dhow anchored there at the mouth of the Lapston Gorge and walked up it looking for kangaroos or something for food and dropped his axe. He might have been marking the trail. The axe could have been broken. One way or another, it was left there. So no doubt they would have followed a similar line to the Aborigines, and perhaps many of these strange carvings are found in Aboriginal areas. Next design, please. This is the Gympie Ape. Queensland has produced a number of strange symbols. A ship was seen by Captain Cook as he sailed past Facing Island off Proserpine. His whole crew saw the ship. It was the wreck of a Spanish galleon on the rocks, and it was still there in 1853 when Colonel Barney visited the site. But, of course, naturally enough, Cook soft-pedaled the fact when he got back to England, because it had been over a day prior, pre-British discoverer. The natives thereabouts have Latin features, and some Spanish words are still spoken. A few years ago, Aborigines were found to be playing around with Spanish gold doubloons. But, of course, these could have been brought here in the days of the Holy Dollar. But in one area, it was noted that there were strange carvings at Townsville, which may or may not yet prove that Torres did land at Townsville and left. The name of some of his officers, his own name included, and another description, one of which was unfortunately vandalised by persons unknown. But this figure was ploughed up in three pieces by a farmer who was bulldozing his property and went around looking for rocks to cement into his patio. He picked up what appeared to be an arm, a leg, a head, and then he realised it was no ordinary stone. He cemented it back together and he took it out in the yard to photograph it and sent me the slide. The Gympie Ape has been interpreted as either a Canaanite god or else it is the Egyptian god Thoth in ape form, looks very much like either. It's greatly weathered. It was made by either metal or good stone tools, but it is not the work of Aborigines, and the conditions under which it was found cancels out the period of the last 200 years. It could have been the work of early seafarers who were here before Captain Cook. In Queensland recently, next slide, they have
many farmers have come across strange things, like in the Mitchell River, a gold scarab. A gold scarab was found in a swamp near Cairns. At Cairns, where the papyrus plant does not grow natural, a papyrus plant has been found painted in a bluish type oak which was not available to Aborigines and is amongst other strange designs in this rock shelter. All attempts to grow papyrus naturally up there have failed. It can only be grown in hothouses. So whoever painted that papyrus painted it a long time ago, and long before the plant was ever known in Australia. This carving, this strange altar stone may or may not be the work of Aborigines. It is similar to many designs in the Mediterranean, but also similar designs are found all over Mexico, Peru, Yucatan and the Pacific. Eric von Daniken reported when I wrote to him, seeing he had quite a lot of interpretations, I admire a man who's a field worker and doesn't sit behind a desk and invent a lot of theories out of somebody else's books that are 70 or 80 years old. He goes out and looks for new evidence and improves on the old ideas, and sometimes comes up with something that completely destroys the old concepts. This is a 5 foot long by 2 foot wide altar, 4 foot high. It's shaped in the form of a snake. It's on the Blue Mountains, overlooking a very large valley with an excellent view of the heavens. It could have been associated with sun worship because, next slide, the snake is a sun worship symbol of the Mediterranean. Vandals came upon the site one day, without knowing that it was a snake-shaped altar stone, stood on it, climbed down the side and removed a loose slab of rock which they threw off the cliff. And that is why there was a white gash in the distance. It's back to the front, but down the bottom right-hand corner, it should be on the left, you'll see the mouth of the serpent. This serpent is very much akin to a Polynesian and earlier Pacific culture, which Eric von Daniken says has been found all over the Pacific, and it could be interpreted as being the work of early Pacific culture people who actually reached the east coast of Australia. The Polynesians have certainly been here. The Maoris knew of a great land to the west. It is possible that a Central Pacific culture reached the east coast and was, in fact, to implant itself deep inland as far as the Blue Mountains, at Gosford, where there are large blocks of stone, half the size of this room, hollowed out like saucers. Into this, we believe, water was poured because there is a great mound of earth around them, and it's believed that it was an astronomical observatory because if you sat around this pool of water at a night and looked down into the water, you could see the movements of the heavenly bodies. This would save straining one's neck looking skyward all night, and it was, in fact, it is identical to the same type of open-air observatory used by the Polynesians and many other islanders, and similar styles have been found in Central America. Drift voyages this far are possible. American ethnic anthropologists have discovered Mayan artifacts and other Peruvian traits up in the Philippines, Fiji and Solomon Islands, and also the north coast of New Guinea. Some designs in watercraft have been linked by Thor Heyerdahl, not only between the Mediterranean and Egypt, particularly in his papyrus boat voyage. He worked on designs of both sides of the Atlantic, but he also postulates the theory that these same voyages could reach Australia, and recently the La Balsa expedition proved the feasibility of this. I'm quite confident that the early navigators of antiquity have not been given due credit as they should. The trouble with modern-day European historians is that they tend to become too engrossed in the European angle. They never give any consideration to the navigational abilities of other earlier seafaring races. Captain Cook, as I say, was a great seaman, but we shouldn't believe he was first in everything. We were always taught at school that Britain, the great empire in that time, was first in everything, and therefore she was first in exploration, and therefore she must have been first in the discovery of Australia. Perhaps we did more towards the colonisation, and Captain Cook's arrival is important because he is our first, the man whose arrival opens the first page of our modern history, and that is where we should not forget him. But we should not say he was absolutely first and refuse with a closed mind to admit any other evidence that might dispute long-held tradition.
Next slide, please. Another strange altar is found on the Blue Mountains. This is a 25-foot high rock face which is closed from, which is climbed from where we're standing or where we're looking. You climb up this face and then you have to go by a twisting route around the face of the rock by gripping hold of little knife groove type markings. When you get to the top, next slide, you find this. Wrong side in. An eagle. The top is so small and narrow that you have to stand on the tail to photograph the rest of it. I have been lucky to get the whole of the right wing in, but to do that you've got to risk falling off the edge. But who bothered to carve an eagle on top of a rock? It could be an altar stone of some sort, but Aborigines do not carve this type of figure. Once again, could early Pacific drift voyages have reached Australia and left some of their art styles here, because the eagle, if it is an eagle, and the snake are associated with sun worship to the early Pacific cultures, and the Olmecs, particularly the Olmecs, one of the earlier cultures of Central America, and if not most of the cultures of Central America. Next slide. Beneath the altar is this strange snake-like figure carved on a rock. Next slide. On the south coast there is evidence of other more recent explorers. We know that Cook and others used Portuguese maps, and it's pretty certain that Portuguese were on our west coast. There was in fact a race between Portugal and Spain to claim the Southland. This is quite, in fact, very well recorded, particularly the voyage of Mendana in 1595, which floundered when his second in command, Lope de Vega, mutinied and stole two of the ships out of the four to search for gold. Mendana was ordered to claim the great Southland for Holy Spain and convert any heathen savages he might find to the one true faith. That's probably why he took the 400 or 500 soldiers with him and a few settlers. And he had already established a colony in the Solomons 28 years before, when his expedition failed in the Marquesas, when the ships disappeared. He sailed for the Solomons and there ended his attempt. But did the Santa Barbara and Santa Isabel and the Lope de Vega reach the east coast? This has been postulated by the late Norman Lindsay and Lawrence Hargraves, who discovered carvings near Botany Bay in about 1912, and they were interpreted as having been the work of Lope de Vega. Down near Eden, strange remains have been found. The wreck of a ship off the coast of Itatha has been identified as a Spanish galleot. It's clinker built, 50 feet long, about 10, 15 foot wide, put together with wooden pegs. No metal nails have been used. It shows rowing compartments just like a Viking ship, but once again it shows unmistakable Spanish design. What is a Spanish galleot, a ship used for mapping purposes, doing on the east coast of Australia? Further south, a similar wreck, much larger, believed to be Spanish because of the items recovered by skin divers on it, has been found off Gabo Island. But in Eden Harbour, such things as Spanish helmet and breastplate have been dredged up. A 12th century Castilian wine jar has been found, which is now in the Eden Historical Museum. The Australian Museum confiscated the helmet, breastplate and other items from this ruin near Eden, and they are now hidden in the Australian Museum. I think these things should be brought to the public's notice and put on public display and allow the public to draw their own conclusions and not be told what to think. This ruin is actually about 250 square feet in circumference. It is very well made. The next slide, please. The fort, as it is termed, has an outer wall, which could have been anything up to 8 feet high. Its only entrance faces west and is as narrow as a modern doorway. There are signs that there was a ramp up there, and this has fallen outwards. The whole wall has collapsed outwards, but you see the outline of where the entrance was. The inner part of the fort shows well cut and dressed stones. The wall was made of just natural stone blocks, but or at least rocks rather, they were not carved. The ruin of the dwelling site itself is made of beautifully cut and dressed sandstone, cemented together by shell grit, which the builders actually obtained by a nearby Aboriginal shellmen, which they burnt down in a open fireplace which you can still see dug in the ground, but they burnt the shell down to make lime for the cement. Thereabouts, large pieces of metal can still be found here and there, fragments of metal containers. Oh yes, a musket barrel was found there by the Eden Historical Society. Vandals do not know of the site, which is good. I have been given a piece of the shell grit, but if it is Spanish, it's in a very good position. Without trees thereabouts, and we believe at some stage the trees may have been cut down for a good distance around so as to get a good view in case Aborigines tried to surprise them. If it is Spanish, it remains to be seen further. Not enough research has been done on it, but as I say, Spanish items are being found there. Of course, British settlers might have dressed up in Spanish helmets and breastplates too. Next slide. Up at Gosford, at Girakul National Park, the ranger will be pleased to show anyone interested their proud little space Spaniard figure. Spaceman. The Spaniard has the barrel chest, which could be the outline of a breastplate. Use your own interpretation, this is only mine. The spiked elbows and knees could be the armour joints, and the left leg shows the outline of a trouser leg, and also boots can be seen. Here could be a Spanish soldier or seaman of the 16th, 17th century. Who knows? Slide. Back to front. We then come on to strange carvings, such as these four Latin doodles, which have been found by Rick Weil up at Gosford. The site is a secret to him, although he took me there in April 1970. And nearby we found a road cut up the mountainside with great trees, anything up to 3 to 4 foot or more thick, growing up through this ancient road. Eric Weil claims that it was the work of early timber getters, but then again, or at least he says it could be the work of timber getters, but these symbols have him thinking, because they're not of the usual style of the early settlers. They could be translated. I sent photographs some time ago of these and others to Father Celsus Kelly of the Madrid Archives, who was a world authority on Spanish sea voyages in the Pacific. In those times, Spain and Portugal, not wanting one another to know that they had the location of the Great South Land, produced maps showing what could be Australia with Cape York and Arnhem Land crudely depicted, but pushing it either farther south or further towards Africa, or sometimes joining the tip of South America. Both possibly never knew that one or the other already knew their secret, or both had been here, but nonetheless both had it on their statute that anyone caught passing on maritime maps or information of any sort to any foreign power of the Great South Land could be punished by death. Next slide. This, a farmer ploughed up on his farm in western New South Wales near Oberon. In that area, when the first settlers journeyed there, they found Aborigines with strange features speaking what could be Spanish words, but they shot the poor devils out before they could study them enough. This was found in 1968 and is now in my collection. The doodles, as far as we know, represent the symbol for gold. The Latin D, the capital letter D down the bottom left-hand corner shows a circle with a dot. The early Egyptian symbol for gold, which was used by the early Spaniards, and this has something to do with gold has been discovered. Whether it is a treasure map or something, we don't know. The outline of a Spanish carac has been interpreted almost in the centre of the picture. You see the outline of a possible ship. The sacred symbol in the bottom right-hand corner, and there is a letter A in the top right-hand corner almost disappeared where an edge had been broken off. But the early settlers, when they entered the district, found an open-cut mine in 1850, before gold was officially discovered. No one knew, even the Aborigines didn't know, who carved it except the culture heroes. Whoever the culture heroes were, they left a strange carving on the side of what was to be called the Isabella River, the word Isabella. And that is why the Isabella River got its name. It could have been the early Spanish
colonists had reached Australia, some perhaps coming up via Eden through the Riverina up behind the Blue Mountains, and there worked for gold. Evidence lately come to light in the Madrid archives could provide evidence eventually. It's almost dead certain that they were here. There's not enough evidence as far as some people are concerned that they were, but it is open to speculation whether or not they did mine for gold, because according to one Spanish don, his ancestors reached the Southland, established a colony. He produced maps which provide evidence that there was a settlement somewhere in the Eden district and that they journeyed further inland. It could have been that they were all over Eastern Australia at some stage, and of course gold would attract Spaniards like mice to cheese. Next slide. And if Spaniards, Portuguese, Chinamen and anybody else was here before Captain Cook, there's certainly a lot of circumstantial evidence, but there is a lot of evidence that can't be disputed. There is the indisputable evidence which is of course hushed up. For example, the mummification in Egypt has been found to be linked with Australia. In 1946, the British Museum retrieved a greenstone tiki from a Nile tomb. In 1964, British Museum scientists, after studying up to 35 mummies, discovered that from about 1500 BC onwards, the mummification technique was used with the help of eucalyptus oils, which were employed in the embalming process. Now, as eucalyptus could only have come from either Australia or New Guinea, it seems reasonable to assume that Mediterraneans must have been hereabouts to obtain such a commodity to take it back to Egypt. And here is one last mystery from Tutankhamun's tomb. African and Asiatic prisoners bound to one of the king's walking sticks. Well, this is how Howard Carter interpreted it. It was the only way he could interpret it. But M. Skander Ibrahim, who has seen similar figures and indeed racial features in the Kimberleys, and is a multilingualist who has studied the Aboriginal dialects and linked many of their dialects and words with those of the early Mediterranean languages, he says that definitely the Asiatic or the African figure is an Assyrian bowman, and this was agreed to by Petrie. But the figure on the right, if you look at his, apart from the strange clothing he's wearing, you see a head that is very similar to, if not identical to, heads of Aborigines up in the Kimberleys today. Could he be an Aboriginal? I'll leave it to you. Any questions?
Yes, what was it you were saying about the museum actually taking some of this?
They were confiscated.
Can museums confiscate things?
Well, this is it. They did it with a blind eye. The new legislation says that relics must be protected, which is a good thing. Unscrupulous people might try to sell artefacts as antiques. There's a big business overseas until the New Guinea natives pounced on all their ancient relics. A lot of the best material, the type specimens, were turning up in America and other countries, and now they've stopped all this undercover exploitation or exporting the materials. In Australia, the museums are obliged to protect Aboriginal rock art and other things, but they have no right, in my opinion, they have no right to go to a historical society museum when an old fellow who was the caretaker there, they knew he was easily walked over. They threatened him with court action and everything, and there was no one else around, and he gave in without thinking and said, "Oh, well, you better take it, we don't want to get into trouble," and they confiscated the whole lot. Oh, but they were generous, they left him with the wine jug. But luckily the Bega Historical Society, if you ever wish to contact them, can tell you more. They have some interesting items, a Polynesian ad and a something looks like a plough here. It was found up down in the Bega area. It's a definite Polynesian origin. But they have found that it has been found that they have no real right to take some of these items. What gave them the right to just walk in and claim all these items? Nothing, but no one can fight the government, unfortunately. But it would have been all okay if they'd have put them on public display, but they haven't. They've hidden them. who also have hidden a gold scarab. I have seen it in 1967 on Australian Museum drawer. It came from somewhere up in the Dalley River in the Northern Territory. A famous bronze coin dating to the time of Ptolemy the IV was found up in Cape York under suspicious circumstances in 1912 by a Scottish farmer, Andy Henderson. He found it in the rainforest when he cleared it to build a farm, the first white settler there. He established his farmhouse slap bang in the centre of an ancient Aboriginal migration trail leading down to Cairns. 6 feet underground while he was digging fence post holes, he came up with a coin. This coin is one of the best pieces of evidence for ancient seafarers having reached Australia. Whether an Egyptian or a Phoenician or someone brought it here, we don't know who brought it. But it shows that somebody from the Mediterranean must have brought it here, and the Aborigines either bumped the poor devil off and got his coin, or else he gave it to him as a trinket for something, or else they obtained it after somebody had dropped it and brought it up the migration trail. And it's possible also that a Mediterranean seaman looking for food might have dropped it. Michael Terry writes in one of his famous articles that a coin bag could have fallen open and the coin had been dropped. Who knows? But it is one of the most important relics. And as far as everyone in Queensland is concerned, Egyptians or people like them were definitely in northern Queensland, particularly in Cape York, at least 2,000, 2,500 years ago. Most historians up that way support the idea, whereas New South Wales is more pro-Captain Cook, I'm afraid. Cookomania is an unfortunate disease in this part of the world, and I'm often lucky if I don't get heckled for these claims in this state. Next question, what?
Why aren't there a lot more
of evidence?
Surely those people were around about
the
Tudor.
Was there
more things
behind? Things are coming to light all the time. This is only my own evidence. A farmer ploughed up a stone on his property of Rockhampton with strange designs. A ship.
Rather strange that we should have this lecture this year, but we blinders by some heavy celebration because most of us will have read in Flinders Love, that in his circumnavigation of Australia, he did encounter in the Gulf of Carpentaria a fleet of 100 Chinese junks, recorded clearly in his account of that particular voice. The other point which comes to my mind is the Portuguese reference you made, because tonight we have with us Commander Roberts, whose father was a cave discoverer of a Portuguese cavern in Broome. There are two caverns, as a matter of fact. These were identified and they were carved in 1545, and there's every indication that they arrived in Australia within a period of 40 or 50 years of that time, which placed them ahead, of course, of the Dutch. Well, we've enjoyed your lecture, Mr. Gilroy, and I'm going to ask now Commander Churchill to move a vote of thanks on our behalf.
It has certainly been very fascinating.
Thank you very much, sir.
It certainly has been very fascinating. And thank you very much. It was when I first met you down in the Liverpool Historical Society, that was the night, I think, that you first met Professor Abraham.
Yes.
And it was so wonderful to see these two people get together for the first time on their two subjects, which were so close, and it was fascinating to watch the two of them together, sorting out their ideas and interlocking their various theories. But you've given us wonderful photographic evidence, and you've left an awful lot of questions.
If anybody wants to know more.
Thank you very much indeed.
It was a very great pleasure.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ship's plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.